the Deco Retro program here on Planet FM. We will bring you interesting interviews, updates of future deco, modern, retro, and other related events. Also the stories that celebrate New Zealand's history and its people, as well as book reviews and other snippets capturing the glamour and fascination of a bygone era.
Deco Retro, Deco Retro.
Welcome to the Deco Retro program. Shaken, not stirred. Those words will forever be associated with the hero of Ian Fleming's novels, James Bond, and the movies that followed, transporting one into a world of luxury, glamour, excitement, and danger. I've always enjoyed the Bond movies. A number of actors have taken on the role of James Bond since the first movie, Dr. No, in 1962. But for me, Sean Connery, with his dangerously dark good looks and cynical sense of humour, will always be my favourite portrayal of Ian Fleming's iconic hero. However, there are, in fact, two James Bonds. One is the hero of Ian Fleming's novels. The other is the 007 of the cinema screen. The first is Fixed in Time, a product of World War II, who lived in the 1950s and early 60s. He shared the class background, the war experiences, the tastes, and the general outlook of his creator. He lived in a country still subject, in 1953, to rationing and shortages of money, housing, luxuries, good meals and elegant clothes. Although he could enjoy these things, he paid for them through the stress of his work, which was dirty and dangerous. He was often exhausted, wounded or traumatized. He lacked humour. And occasionally even confidence. He felt periodic melancholy with his role and sometimes doubted whether the West had any right to feel morally superior to its communist enemy. He even, in one novel, shredded his nerves with worry. The Bond of the movies, who grew from this character, is not stuck in a particular time. He belongs to the 1960s and to every decade since, for he is continually reborn, recreated, replaced, and updated. He is never fazed by the unfamiliar or the threatening, and he never hesitates or wonders what to do. He is an expert on any required subject. And he has so much humour that his conversation sometimes consists of little else. He is a more reckless driver than his counterpart. He travels more widely. He seduces more women. And he kills more men. His gadgetry is more extensive and more elaborate. He is an entirely different person. And he is far better known. More of us have seen him on screen in one or other of his seven personifications than will ever read books about him. Indeed, it is estimated that over half the world's population have watched at least one of his movies. It is of the cinema Bond that we automatically think when we conjure up an image of 007. From time to time, there are attempts to make the movie Bond more ordinary, like the Bond of the novels, or more in keeping with contemporary attitudes and expectations. Perhaps he drinks and smokes less, or not at all. He is less fastidious, more casual in dress. He is less posh, although care is taken that his attitude to women remains cheerfully behind the times. Such a makeover has happened most recently when Daniel Craig took over the role. Although he is far less polished than Fleming would probably have wished, he has won praise from serious fans for portraying 007 in a manner more faithful to the original. The women, too, have changed. To begin with, they were more helpless, more in need of protection, more adoring. Not all, admittedly, were this type. One thinks of Tracy D. Vincenzo in On Her Majesty's Secret Service, or the Havelock daughter in For Your Eyes Only. These days, however, the women are independent, invulnerable, more skilled, less willing to be rescued, more likely to help defeat the enemy, and more resentful of Bond's attitude towards them. Although Bond and the Bond women have changed, the villains have remained much the same. They are uniformly wealthy, deranged, physically abnormal, charming, and surprisingly patient, considering the frequency with which 007 irritates and frustrates them. Modernized and reinterpreted for each new generation, Bond has outlasted his original context, a grim and austere post-war world in the grip of East-West confrontation, and is even more popular in the new era of affluence and global terrorism. Why has he proved so durable? And why do people all over the world enjoy the adventures of what one American called a limey cop? The reasons are fourfold. Firstly, because the themes are universal, an audience in any country can enjoy the agent's hairsbreadth escapes and feel relief when he outwits an assassin or dispatches an undesirable. If Bond is the projection of a typical middle-aged man's fantasies, such men are to be found all over the globe. Secondly, the movies are completely international in their settings, casting and situations, and only some of the characters are British. The villains, of course, virtually never are. Thirdly, Britain has a small but highly professional movie industry. The facilities and crews are excellent and now have decades of experience in making Bond movies. This technical expertise means that the movies are visually spectacular. And fourthly, many worldwide viewers have stereotyped notions of the English and enjoy seeing these brought to the screen in the shape of M, Q, and Bond himself. Any audience can enjoy the escapism offered by the world of Bond. He is what so many of us would want to be. Invincible, bereft of doubts or hang-ups, and with the lifestyle of the internationally rich. At first, in his early years, he was envied because he could travel without restriction to places that were beyond the reach of most. He could dine on food that was unfamiliar, expensive, and unrationed. He could spend other people's money, the government's, and, most importantly perhaps, he could have sex with virtually any woman he met. Now, millions can live something of the James Bond lifestyle. Pleasures that once seemed unattainable have been brought within our reach by a rising standard of living. More and better restaurants, budget airlines, and the contraceptive pill. Yet Bond still remains above and beyond the broad mass of humanity because he is untroubled by everyday concerns. And he remains refreshingly aloof from the cares that preoccupy others. We never see him queuing in shops, paying a fine because his car has been clamped, or having his clothes ruined in the wash. He has no wife to nag him, no children to go off the rails because he was not there during the crucial years of their adolescence. He does not have to pay alimony or struggle to afford school fees. He is never, in fact, short of money or financially embarrassed. His problems, and they are serious enough, goodness knows, involve saving his life, saving the heroine, saving the country, or indeed the world. But otherwise, he never experiences even the difficulty of having to look for a parking space. And every time he starts to get too old to chase villains or seduce women, he is replaced by a younger, fitter version of himself and carries on. Who would not dream of being this man? Physically, James Bond is effectively his creator, Ian Fleming, who lived from 1908 to 1964, projected onto a larger screen. The description of 007 is broadly similar to that of the author, with the addition of a scar to suggest Bond's adventurous past. Fleming was admittedly slightly older than his character. 007 is in his mid-30s, while his creator was 43 at the outset. But this is a minor point. Fleming did not specify that he himself was the model for 007, but the similarities were obvious to those around him and did no harm to the author's image or his sales. In terms of character, Fleming had had no difficulty crafting the personality of Bond from a number of men he had known during the war, commandos, naval officers, and agents. Finding the right name was somewhat trickier. Fleming's first choice had been, frankly, ludicrous. Peregrine Maltravers. This was far too cumbersome and sounded hopelessly old-fashioned, a reflection of the Bulldog Drummond era of the 1920s in which lay the roots of Fleming's inspiration. He needed something that would fit into the contemporary world more easily, and that was both slick and bland. When in 1953 he was writing the first of the novels, Casino Royale, at his desk in Jamaica, his glance fell on a nearby book. It happened to be The Field Guide to Birds of the West Indies by James Bond. According to Fleming legend, the author immediately borrowed the name and found that it perfectly suited his purpose. There are other explanations for this name. In 1945, Fleming, still working in London for naval intelligence, was already thinking of writing a book. In conversation about this with his friend, C.H. Forster, Forster asked how Fleming thought of names for his characters. Fleming explained that it was relatively easy. He would think of the first couple of names of the boys in his house at school and swap their Christian names. In his case, Forster said the first names were James Aitken and Harry Bond. This meant that the result would be Harry Aitken and James Bond. Apparently, Fleming had felt that James Bond sounded the better of the two. In addition, one of the rugged wartime acquaintances on whom his hero was to be modelled had been a friend of Fleming's brother, Peter, a commando, named Rodney Bond. James Bond might, in any case, have seemed familiar. The a sort of name one would feel one had heard before. In fact, it had already been used for a character in a short story by Agatha Christie called The Raja's Emerald, published in 1934. And St. James Bond is even the name of a church in Toronto, Canada. The name quickly came to seem the only suitable one for Fleming's suave and ruthless creation. The author wanted a name that was as ordinary as possible, and later explained that it seemed to him this choice was brief and unromantic, Anglo-Saxon and yet very masculine, exactly what the character needed. Neither Fleming nor his early readers could have had any notion of just how romantic it would eventually become in the minds of the public. As a courtesy, Fleming contacted the name's real owner to see if he had any objection to its use, although only after he had begun using it. The true James Bond, an American from Philadelphia, though educated at Harrow and Cambridge in England, was a highly respected museum ornithologist. He replied that he was fine with it, and that was that. The two men met for lunch during the last months of Fleming's life at Goldeneye, and Fleming sent Bond a first edition of his book, You Only Live Twice. The inscription to the real James Bond was from the thief of his identity. The real James Bond died aged 89 in 1989. Despite his generosity in lending his name, one wonders if he ever got used to the hilarity that must have greeted him every time he tried to book a restaurant table. Fleming initially sought to make the character of James Bond an empty vessel, without tastes or opinions. He was to remark that his intention was to invent a hero with no characteristics, who simply operated at what he called a blunt instrument at the behest of the government. In writing about Bond, however, he began to endow him with his own interest in food, drink, clothes, and women. As a result, his hero became synonymous with sophistication, not to mention a certain overt snobbiness, as well as adventure, and this greatly increased the popular appeal. Fleming admitted that similarities were unavoidable as his agent began to eat and to dress in a certain way, gradually assuming a personality that the writer's friends recognized as the author's own. Fleming also revealed that his fictional hero was a means of living the life he himself would have wanted. He actually referred to one novel, on completing it, as the latest chapter of his autobiography. The similarities between himself and his creation naturally made it easier to write the books and lent them an unmistakable authenticity. Fleming, however, played down any physical or temperamental similarity between himself and Bond, saying that apart from the fact that they wore the same type of clothes, they had little in common, and that although there were certainly things he envied in 007, his efficiency and his blondes, his success with women was, after all, even more legendary than Fleming's own. He did not much like him. Nevertheless, there can be little doubt that Fleming relished their common characteristics. He described his books as fairy tales for adults, and one critic less charitably wrote that they were the pillow fantasies of an adolescent mind. Perhaps so, but they were fantasies shared by a significant number of others. Another observer commented that Bond represented an amalgamation of all the daydreams of not only Fleming himself, but also several million other men from all over the world. Before we finish, let's listen to some of those fabulous Bond movie songs. We'll start with Goldfinger, sung by the inimitable Shirley Bassey. And then perhaps we'll listen to Diamonds Are Forever. And there's a couple more if we have time. There's only You Only Live Twice and For Your Eyes Only. Bye for now.
yourself and one for your dreams. You drift through the years and life seems tame. Till one dream appears and love is its name.
Stream it.